Howard G. Buffett is one of the Buffetts. His father, financier Warren Buffett, gave him $3 billion. And with that money, Howard Buffett set out to help the billion people on Earth who lack food security. And he gave himself a deadline to try to achieve this goal, 40 years. Howard Buffett has written about his work in a new book called 40 Chances, Finding Hope in a Hungry World. Besides being a philanthropist, Howard Buffett is a farmer and an auxiliary deputy sheriff in rural Illinois. Thank you so much for stopping by today.
Hey, it's great to be here.
And you talk about yourself a lot in this book and your relationship to your father a little bit. You talk about at one point you wanted to get some money to purchase some equipment, and you say, I knew my father wouldn't loan me the money.
No, but yeah, that was the one time where having a last name paid off, because I walked into the bank and they just made the assumption I could pay the loan back. So I don't think I filled out all the paperwork even.
How long have you been working on this 40-year project on world hunger?
Well, I'm going to run out of my 40 years, I think, before I get done. But, yeah. You know, we've been working for a long time on different issues. But in 2006, my dad really stepped up the amount of financial resources we had in the foundation, and then he did it again last year. And so, you know, we've had about 7 or 8 years of some reasonable financial resources that we've been trying to figure out, you know, how can we get the best out of those resources.
How much have you spent of the total assets?
I'd have to go back. Well, I tell you what we do. We get in a certain amount of stock every year, and it's a predetermined amount. So this year we got in about $135 million, $140 million worth of stock. And our goal is to give that amount of money away every year. So we're not trying to build an endowment. We have an endowment of a few hundred million dollars, but that just allows us to do a big idea if something comes along.
Why did you decide to write a book about it?
Well, you know, actually I started out thinking that I've been to 130 countries and talked to thousands of, you know, farmers and government officials, and I came back a few years ago and I thought maybe what I do is write a textbook, because, you know, this is something I've learned and maybe students would learn something from it. And my son said, Dad, you got to think bigger than that. And usually I think pretty big, but I wasn't thinking big. A book is not something I don't know how you do that. So it kind of turned into going from the idea of just providing lessons for students and like a textbook to writing this book. And we just hope that, I mean, I hope that the lessons I've learned, we failed on a lot of things. And I think that's one of the most important things to talk about. And we hope people learn from it.
Yeah, and I want to talk about successes and failures. But you're praised by those who know your work as someone who doesn't just sit in an office somewhere. You get out there and see what's actually going on. And there's one of the incidents you convey that you have some photographs of that's truly shocking, children in chains.
Oh, yeah. Now, that was also a close call getting out of there. It was in Senegal. That was quite a while ago. And we talked to these individuals into letting us go in and meet these kids, and some were chained to trees, and some were shackled, and some were shackled together. It was you just don't think that those things exist anymore. And you learn that there's different cultures and different religions in this case that promote things that are very foreign to us. And the biggest thing that came out of that was ultimately I used the photographs through the government to get health officials in to visit those kids who hadn't had that happen. I have no idea what the status is today, unfortunately.
Your project is a huge project dealing with world hunger. And to fix a problem, though, you need to kind of know the cause of it. What have you learned about why there is still hunger in the world?
Well, most of it's politics. I mean, it really comes down to politics, because it's what kind of policies do you have in place that allow people to have access to food or afford food or whatever? And, you know, obviously it's completely different in this country, where you still have 50 million food insecure people today, than it is in Africa. But in Africa, the politics are a little more raw sometimes. And we work in a lot of countries where there's, you know, either current conflict or they're post-conflict countries. So our exposure to hunger has a lot to do with conflict.
Mm-hmm. If it's politics, it's hard for philanthropies to work for political change. Countries, for some reason, don't like it when philanthropies do that. They kick them out right away. So you're not able to work in that field very much.
Well, but what we do is we try to come up with models or push ideas that we can actually fund somehow that will get attention of different, you know, prime ministers, presidents, you know, whoever it is that we're trying to influence to change the policy. you know, what we do is we try to do it by example. And we're doing something very different in North Kivu and Eastern DRC. You know, we're going to—
That's the Democratic Republic.
Democratic Republic of Congo. We're going to spend over $40 million directed in North Kivu this year. And we're building the largest infrastructure project, a new hydroelectric plant. We're building some roads. We're doing different things that typically we don't do, but what we feel needs to happen there. And we think, you know, we want to develop during the conflict and show that, that you can still invest in people and places, you know, even though things aren't perfect. But hopefully that investment then gives people more to lose, which means in turn they want to see peace and stability, and they will demand that.
Do you run up against the forces that would like to take some of your philanthropy and work for the people's well-being and just take it for themselves in some way, take advantage of that money being spent?
You're always up against that.
Yeah.
And almost anywhere. I mean, you're up against it in anywhere we work. And sometimes it just comes in different forms or fashions. It's amazing how other people think that they're the most important, or their cause is the only thing, or that, you know, I've probably learned how to say no better than anything I've learned in the last 10 years.
Howard Buffett is my guest. His new book is called 40 Chances, Finding Hope in a Hungry World. It refers to a 40-year project of his to try to do some things to alleviate world hunger. And you're a farmer. I don't want to talk about how that comes to bear on this work of having to do with food, but of all the things that would be available for Warren Buffett's son to do, how did you become a farmer?
You know, the first thing is my dad would tell you his dad, the greatest gift that he got from his dad was the fact that his father said, just do what you love doing, find something that you're passionate about, and then you'll do it well. And my dad passed that down to all of us three kids, and my mom was 100% behind that. So we had a very fortunate set of circumstances in many ways, but one way was we never had parents that said, you need to go to law school, you need to go to medical school, you need to do this. So I went out, and I loved equipment, I loved the outdoors, I loved building things, and so I got into farming, and you know, it's actually turned out to be kind of a core part of a lot of what I did in my career.
Farming is so hard. I mean, I spent a little bit of time on a farm one summer, and boy, you just work morning to night, particularly when the harvest is coming in.
You need to come see me. It's not so hard in Illinois.
You've got the right equipment.
Yeah, we got the right. We work long hours.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah.
So one of the things you're known for is when you go out to check out some of these places, you go to the farms and see how that's
going. Oh, absolutely. There's, yeah. I mean, there's no place I'd rather be than in the dirt talking to some farmer. And I'll tell you, you learn from farmers in Kenya. You learn from farmers in Ghana. You learn from farmers in Guatemala. I mean, they are in such different circumstances than we are. And so the key is to listen to them and understand what it is they need instead of thinking that you've got the answer.
And what have you learned from – give me an example of something you've learned from talking to them, because obviously they don't have the resources that an American farmer would have to bring to bear to grow the best crops. How can you be appropriate in your aid to them so it works in their circumstances?
Well, the one thing I've learned, which isn't quite what you're asking, but it's probably the biggest lesson or the most shocking lesson I learned was I didn't realize that there were millions of farmers who couldn't feed their family. So, you know, I would show up somewhere and I'm talking to them about some idea, and it took me a while to understand this is a lot more basic than I'm getting. I mean, that you know, these farmers experience hunger periods. So they have kids that go to bed hungry. They have kids that die because they can't feed them. And that is so foreign to me, thinking that, you know, you're a farmer producing food. So that's the starting point for us with a majority of the farmers that we work with, is that they are, you know, they don't have access to the knowledge. They don't have the training. They don't have the government support. They don't have the infrastructure. We can't overcome all of that. So what we've done is we've focused more on what kind of models can be different. And we found a few of those models.
You know, I've talked to people who criticize U.S. food aid programs for really discouraging farming in developing nations, particularly when there's famine. Boats will arrive with food purchased from U.S. farmers, and they'll load them onto trucks, go right past warehouses that are full of locally grown food to take the aid there, because so much of our food aid in the U.S. is premised on purchasing it from U.S. farmers. I'm wondering if you think that's accurate.
Well, I think there's parts of that are accurate,
yes.
But I think it's really important to say this country's had the greatest legacy of feeding more people in the world than anybody ever. And it's been important. When you have droughts and you have floods and you have emergencies, we are the most responsive country there is. And we have saved millions of lives that way. And the fact that we have a productive farming system allows us to do that. Now, the other side of that is no system is perfect. So we have a couple things we do that aren't very good. We have a part of a program we write about in 40 Chances called monetization, which is more in line with what you're talking about, which is where we ship food over NGOs, sell the commodities, the U.S. commodities, into the local market to get cash to fund their programs. Well, that totally disrupts, typically, it totally disrupts a local market. It's a bad idea, and we call it out in this book. And we talk about an NGO, CARE, who actually made a huge financial sacrifice by on ethical grounds, said we don't believe in it. So it's not a perfect system, but our system has been the most responsive and the most generous of anybody in the world through hundreds and hundreds of times when there's great need.
Give us an example of something that really worked in your work so far, Howard Buffett, and then an example of something that really failed badly.
Well, one thing that's worked is we worked with the World Food Program on something called Purchase for Progress, which is pulling up those farmers who have never been in the market chain, in the value chain, but yet are close to it, and we've been able to use the purchasing power of World Food Program as a crutch to get them into the market, and then hopefully they sell, like we're doing it big we're targeting 50,000 farmers in four countries in Central America. We hope those farmers begin selling to Maseca or Bimbo or one of the other companies eventually, but it's because we have this leverage that we can do. That model is working, and it's proving to show that it works, and we've been able to transfer that concept to companies, actually Starbucks, Green Mountain, Coca-Cola. We've got companies we're working with that are creating the jobs through a model like that.
And what's an idea you thought was a great idea but turned out to be a terrible idea?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's one that a lot of people think is a great idea, and we learned the hard way, spent a lot of money and pretty big disappointments, just running out and drilling wells. Drilling water wells. It sounds like a great idea. A lot of times it is a great idea, but if you don't look at the hydrology, you don't look at the impact on the watershed, you don't know how to deal with the bigger policies that are in play, you don't do it culturally acceptable in terms of how the long-term system works. I mean, there's all sorts of mistakes you can make by doing that, and we made a lot of those mistakes early on, and we learned that we couldn't just say, let's go put 10,000 pins on a map and say we drilled 10,000 wells. It doesn't work that way.
Howard Buffett. He, with his son, Howard W. Buffett, has written 40 Chances, Finding Hope in a Hungry World. It's about his 40-year project to try to do some things to alleviate world hunger. And it's a 40-year project that he's embarked upon. How many more years to go?
I can't answer that. Every time I go off to a few of the places I go to, my wife says, I hope you come back. So I don't know.
A pleasure to meet you, Howard.
Thank
Thanks for
you,
stopping
Rod.
By.
Really appreciate it.
This is The Record on KUOW.